Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey everyone, this is Seth Meyers, and you're listening to the Late Night Podcast Summer Friday Edition.
All summer long, our Summer Friday series brings you fully original content produced just for the Late Night Podcast. On this final episode of the summer, Seth has an exclusive long-form interview with Jason Kander, who is running for mayor of Kansas City and hosts the podcast Majority 54. Plus, we have an exclusive comedy sketch recorded just for the Late Night Podcast, followed by some summer reading recommendations from the Late Night staff. Now, let's get to the show.
Well, let's get started. I'm so happy to have you here. Thanks. Jason Kander is joining us, everybody. And I always feel a little extra stressed doing this when I'm talking to someone who's also a podcast host.
Oh, well, I'm heavily edited when I do it.
Oh, interesting.
So don't worry about it.
About 20 episodes into your podcast?
Yeah,
I've
done 20. So if I just instinctively am like, oh, I'm going to take that again.
Oh, then where?
That's because I'm used to being edited, and we'll just have to remember I can't do that now.
Yeah, we'll just fully leave that in. Yeah. We will fully leave that in. So you, for those who don't know, and this is very exciting, just the intricacies of how this is going to work. I'm talking to you tomorrow on the show, yet this is going to air after that.
So do I need to suspend reality in some way?
No, you don't need to
suspend. I had a great time on the show.
Well, that's the thing. We're going to assume that you had a great time on the show.
Well, that's fair.
But there are some things I'm going to leave for the show, but of course people can go and watch those because they will have already happened.
You're a pro.
Yeah, exactly.
You're a pro.
You were the first millennial to serve in state office.
Yes,
you were Secretary of State in Missouri.
Yeah.
And because of that, and one of the things you speak about a lot now is what you learned from serving in local office.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that you learned from serving in local office?
So, like, as Secretary of State, you mean?
Well,
really, in general, running for office and serving in office, I think a lot of it was, and part of what I sort of emphasize in the book, is that it's so much of what I learned was just about affirming what I had taken from my service in the Army. So, you know, I said this on TV once, and people laughed at me, literally, when I said being a good politician actually is largely about trying to be a good person. And people, that was like a controversial and bold statement.
Right.
But it's true. I mean, it's just like in the Army, I learned be responsible, you know, live up to what you say you're going to do. And then I tried to do that running for office, tell the truth. And it turns out when you do that, it's disarming. People were like, What is this? So that's really what I learned, is just try and be a decent person.
Your book's called Outside the Wire, which, of course, refers to when you go off base.
Mm-hmm.
And your podcast right now is, to a great extent, about talking to people that are sort of outside of anyone's personal bubble. Like, how do you talk to Trump voters if you're someone who is not? Is that something that was informed by your service?
Yeah, I think it definitely it was, because, you know, I am a guy who's from Kansas City, who I'm a Jewish guy from a comfortable background. Like, there was no politician that could make a decision that was going to take food off my family's table or anything like that. And then the first time in my life that I was ever on the receiving end of bad decisions that were politically driven, I was in a vehicle with no armor in Afghanistan. And on top of that, and the reason I bring up my upbringing is, I made all sorts of friends and really like family members in the military, that because when you're with them over that period of time, your family, that I would probably not have interacted with otherwise. And so I think that that definitely has informed the way I just can, I try never to know a stranger, really.
I read an article that said that when you were serving in Afghanistan, you would hand out Kansas City Royals hats
to
the Afghan people.
The word. Yeah.
Now, I, if my timeline's right, while you were doing that, Kansas City was a terrible baseball team.
We needed new fans.
And
we were willing to go anywhere.
Just a few years after you did that, you indoctrinated a huge group of fans that would have had no favorite baseball team, and you gave them a World Series champion.
I've always imagined that, like, the command, the Afghan command center guy who I gave this hat to in Afghanistan, somewhere around 14 or 15, was like, "Well, it's paid off," you know.
Yeah.
And up until then, was like, "What is this?"
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I would that and Gates barbecue sauce. My mom would send them, and I was an intelligence officer, so building rapport with folks was a big part of the job. And I used that to kind of build rapport with
people. I apologize for my ignorance about Gates barbecue sauce. That is I'm assuming it's local. Is it spicy or is it more just delicious?
It's life-changing.
Okay,
I don't know
gotcha.
If that's a flavor.
Yeah.
But yeah, have you been to Kansas City much?
I have been to Kansas City a few times, but usually it's just in and out to do shows. So I'm I don't get to sample the cuisine too much.
Yeah, so next time, that's what we'll do. We'll go there. It is extraordinary. They have a spicy version. It's hard to explain. It's like if you can picture in your mind the happiest you've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so for those listening at home, just close your eyes and think of your happiest moment. That's every bite.
Were you ever lucky enough to watch Afghani people try it for the first time? Or did you often just have to give it in a jar and then hear about it after the fact?
That is a good point. No, I never got to see it. I think it was mostly just them being very gracious and not knowing what they'd been handed.
It'd be fun. I mean, present any kind of barbecue sauce to a foreign land is a great gift. I commend you.
Yeah, thank you.
You mentioned that you think politics is just about helping people, about telling the truth, and yet that's very jarring to people who have come to expect spin from politicians, a sort of very smooth way of talking that might not always be rooted in honesty. We're in this interesting situation right now where we have this president who I don't think is rooted in honesty, but he also doesn't speak the way politicians have ever spoken before.
Right.
So moving forward, do you think there is something that Democrats can take from the fact that he has at least changed the agreed upon format of speech that we had settled on for politicians?
Yeah, I do. But I actually think we should have learned that lesson a long time ago. Because if you think about President Obama, for instance, I mean, he obviously was a great orator, but he also just talked like the way everybody talks. Like he stated things very plainly. You know, one of the stories I tell in Outside the Wire is about one of the very first doors I ever knocked on when I was running for the state house. And I go up to the door and I'm nervous anyway because it's one of the first doors that I knocked on looking for votes. And the dude comes down the stairs, opens the door, and we're talking for a second. And it becomes clear, like in the first minute, that we totally disagree on this issue that he brought up. I don't even remember what the issue is now, but it was not going well. And I remember thinking, maybe I shouldn't even be doing this. And all I'd ever seen was politicians on TV. So I started politicianing as best I could and just started trying to convince him that actually we agreed. And that made things worse. Then suddenly we were in an argument. And so I just, out of like desperation, I was like, well, I guess we don't agree. Now you know where I stand. Shook his hand, figured I was going to the next horrible, embarrassing failure at the next house. And as I'm walking down his steps, he goes, yeah, that's fair. I'll vote for you and you can put a sign in my yard if you want. And I just learned a lot from that exchange, which is it's not a test. You know, it's not a quiz, and they don't have like an Excel spreadsheet at home where they're going down your positions. They're just trying to figure out, do you really believe what you're saying? And do you really believe it because you think it'll help them as opposed to somebody else? And if you think that what you stand for is the best thing for everybody, then you just make that argument. Some people you convince, some people you don't. But some people you don't convince respect you for just being yourself.
Do you think that's a trap that any politician would fall into, especially one that puts the work into having a position on different issues? You do all this work, now there's 25 issues that you know exactly where you stand on. Is the trap that more often than not, when you're talking to people, they at most care about one or two of those 25 issues?
Yes, but at the same time, it's really, I think, more often than not, what they care about is just like a set of values, you know? And the other thing that I try to lay down in the book is that nobody experiences issues one at a time. Like, we talk about them one at a time, those of us who pay a lot of attention to politics. But I have actually never met a voter who, I mean, they're just experiencing life, you know? I use an example in the book of, like, I'm a huge Royals fan, like you mentioned. So therefore, like a Red Sox fan, I am sort of morally and contractually obligated to hate the Yankees.
Sure.
For a different reason. I mean, mostly it's because we were treated like a farm team affiliate for many years. But that's why I hate him. But if I sit around with like my Royals fan friends and I say, like, you know, Aaron Judge was a pretty obvious pick for Rookie of the Year, you got to admit, nobody's like, get out.
Right.
You know, they're not like, you're not a real Royals fan. And that is how most people experience politics. Like, I got 220,000 votes from folks who voted for Trump in 2016, even though all we agree on is we're both afraid of sharks. And despite that, I just think a lot of people sat around, like in rural Missouri, you know, I met a lot of guys who had breakfast every morning at their local McDonald's. And I think one of them would be like, yeah, but that candor's okay. And nobody was like, get out, Earl. I mean, it just didn't happen. So
you had an interesting election in 2016. You were running for Senate. You finished a couple points behind your opponent in a state that I believe Trump won by 16?
19.
Yeah. So obviously you ran way ahead of Hillary Clinton in regards to results there. Is there anything that you take from that lesson other than what you've already said moving forward for people? Like, obviously, you connected with certain people who voted for Donald Trump in a way that she didn't.
One of the biggest things I take from it is that a lot of it confirmed what I believed. But on top of that, I think what I took from it is that, you know, if people can see that they don't agree with you, but they can see that you really do believe, like, they'll forgive you. They'll forgive you. I refer to it, and I talk about this in the book, about showing your math. It's like I was not the greatest math student, so I would often see the teacher like circle my answer because he disagreed with it. He thought it was the wrong answer. But then I figured out, like, if I showed him my little misadventure along the way, like, he'd put a half point next to that. And that's so, like, the ad that I got known for that went viral where I was blindfolded and talking about why I'm for gun control and putting a rifle together, that was just me saying, like, the NRA is wrong, and I'm right, and I know what I'm talking about. And a lot of people who disagreed with me were like, but he's all right. And I think now I take that. I'm running for mayor of Kansas City right now, and I'm really excited about the campaign. It's going very well, and I get to go all over town and talk to people about what's going on in their neighborhood. And a lot of those conversations may start in one place, but either they or I spend the time convincing the other one. And that's perfectly okay. And mm-hmm. I think a lot of politicians feel like, I have to have every answer before I go into this conversation. And it's like, as a former intelligence officer, I'm going, if you don't ask a bunch of questions, how do you ever have any answers?
You mentioned the ad. You did an ad where you assembled an AR-15 blindfolded while also expressing your position that there should be more gun control, there should be background checks. I always, you know, and I think it would be very easy if you were a gun owner to dismiss an opinion of someone like me who's never held a gun, never understood why people might enjoy them recreationally. And I get that. And so you had this different situation where I guess that was an example of you showing your math. Hey, I know this. I know how this works. I always feel like the future of gun control is in some way going to have to be driven by gun owners who are separate from the political line of the NRA. Do you think there's any hope for that, or am I just being overly optimistic?
No, I think there's a ton of hope for that. And also, I think it's better even than you think for a couple of reasons. One, I don't think the important part is folks who have experience with guns telling their story. I think it's everybody telling their story. I was at an event not long ago, and somebody asked me a similar question during the Q&A, and I asked them, what's the reason why you want to see more reform on guns? And their answer was, I'm tired of having to check for where the door is every time I sit down in a restaurant with my kids and I'm scared. And I said, well, then that's what you should say to people. Because I think anytime you relate your experience, it's just as powerful. And then the other part to it is, it's important that we remember that we've already won this argument. You know, just because a Congress that is made up of a Republican majority that comes from heavily gerrymandered districts and lacks, frankly, the moral sense to, I mean, I think they know. I think they know the right thing to do, and they refuse to do it because they're afraid of losing their jobs. One of the biggest reasons I wrote the book is to make the argument that we need more people in office who have voluntarily done something harder than a reelection campaign. And I think we have too many people like that in Congress. So if you look at every poll, we're winning the argument over guns. And now it's just a matter of getting people in Congress who actually do what the American people want.
So one of the things you've been doing in between your last election and your upcoming election, where you're, as you mentioned, running for mayor of Kansas City, is Let America Vote. So this is an organization that, and again, you mentioned gerrymandering. This is about, well, sort of turning this tide against voter suppression. Have you been enthused by your results so far, or are you more frustrated by what you're coming up against as far as resistance?
Both, but because I was already frustrated. And now I'm not frustrated, I guess, because we're working against it, and that always feels better, and we're having a lot of success. Yeah, so Let America Vote we created it to create political consequences for voter suppression. The short version is the Republicans pretend that this fight over whether to let folks vote is a policy debate, but it's not. It's a political strategy by them to try and win elections. I mean, they figure if they can take certain voters out of the system, they'll win. It's just like when they make decisions about which TV shows to run ads during. And the civil rights movement's still going on. And so we're a part of it, and we're knocking on doors, and we're trying to make sure that anybody who is making it harder to vote, who's in elected office, that we make it harder for them to get reelected. And so since June, we have knocked over 150,000 doors in 5 field offices across the country. And it is really exciting. And I think it's going to make a big difference in November and vote out a lot of people who are trying to make it harder to vote.
Can you at least say, because I would understand why voter suppression would continue to be a tactic, because it seems to have been an incredibly effective tactic.
Yeah.
I mean, is there anything that disabuses anyone from trying to continue the voter suppression tactic?
Losing elections. Yeah. I mean, Republicans do this because it helps them win elections. They look at, and for those listening, I should be more specific, like, because it just sounds like a partisan ad hominem attack. So I should explain. Disabled folks, people of color, lower income folks, working people, college students, basically millennials, and some other groups are less likely to have a photo ID. They are less likely to be able to navigate a really bureaucratic system to be able to vote. And several other tactics they use, like cutting early voting, all make it harder for that group to vote. That group happens to be really unlikely to vote Republican. And so the Republicans, rather than reach out to all those different sets of Americans and try and convince them or change their policies to bring them into the fold, they just figure, let's eliminate them from democracy, solve the problem.
I know it's very easy sometimes, and I would say there are times I'm guilty of it, where you say, oh, this is happening in Trump's America, but this is obviously something that was happening in Barack Obama's America as well. Do you think enough was happening during his 8 years in office to stem the tide of voter suppression?
We were actually on a really good path of winning this battle in the long run, and a big part of that was that we had a Justice Department under President Obama that was, I mean, look, doing what a Justice Department is supposed to do, suing state governments on behalf of voters. And big part of why, there's two big reasons I started Let America Vote. Number one, you had a president of the United States claiming there were 3 to 5 million illegal voters in the election. I argue it's the biggest lie a president's ever told. I haven't checked Twitter since you and I sat down.
Sure, so there's a good chance. There's at least a runner-up.
I mean, yeah, it's probably in third by now. But, and then the other, so that was about undermining democracy so you could pass these laws. And then the next part is, when you put Jeff Sessions as attorney general, he was determined, and it turns out he's done it, to flip sides in every one of those lawsuits. So the United States government went from being on the side of voters to literally in the same courtroom going across and being on the side of vote suppressors. So that meant that we couldn't just have a legal fight anymore. It was still important, but now we had to have a political fight too, just really in a lot of ways to bridge us to the time when we have a Department of Justice that actually wants to fight for civil rights again.
It strikes me that the more you watch the conversations happening about politics right now, it's so divisive. Do you feel like the future, who's going to decide the future of this country, starting with the midterms, are people who did not vote in the last election?
I think that's a lot of it. And a lot of those are people who didn't vote because they weren't old enough. And that's a big part of it, too. But there are definitely people who didn't vote because they just didn't vote. And I know that there are a lot of people out there who get mad when folks talk about that. It's sort of, I think the word now people use is triggers. It triggers something in folks. But there's two ways to relate to this. One, as a lifelong Kansas City Royals fan who saw everybody get very mad when in 14 and 15, suddenly the whole town was wearing blue. I was like, I've been trying to get people to do this the whole time.
Like, right.
Let's embrace this. And then the second thing is that when folks don't vote, that's kind of a vote. And people in my line of work, like as you said, I'm running for office again right now. People in my line of work who go, well, what's their problem? The answer is it's us.
Like, sure.
If people aren't inspired to go vote, that's not necessarily on them exclusively. That's on us too. So I just look at it as we got to be out there. And that's what I'm trying to do every day in Kansas City right now. And it's just give people the inspiration to go do it.
So a podcaster, a mayoral candidate, do you feel like I have not done the research here. Maybe the first candidate for office who's also hosting a podcast, which I have to imagine when you think about things these days is an incredibly effective way of reaching voters.
Yeah, it turns out. I would imagine not the last. I mean, I'm
right.
Sure, you know what's funny about this is like as soon as somebody does one thing, then everybody goes, well, that's the path. So, you know, which is why, like, when you watch the news right now, so many people are like, will it be Oprah? Will it be? It's like, well, clearly it's going to be a television personality. You know? And it's like, well, you know, 5 minutes ago, that wasn't the path. But yeah, I just feel like every day, like, because I'm supposed to be here to pitch the book, I'll capture this, wrap it, you know, that
yes,
was
please.
Transparent, right?
Yeah, of course.
Wrap it in the book, which is that one of the biggest arguments I think I make in Outside the Wire is that you can't make change from within your comfort zone. It's just never been done. And the idea is about getting out there, figuratively outside the wire as well. And that, you know, whether it's a podcast, anything else, whether it's just your platform you have because you have 75 friends on Facebook and 6 coworkers, like that's 81 people. And 54% of the country voted for somebody not named Trump. So if we're all out there having these conversations, like, you don't even need a TV ad or a door-knocking campaign. Like, mm-hmm. You're going to win people over.
Thanks so much for being here. Thanks in
Thank
advance
you.
For being here tomorrow night. Which
I
is
really enjoyed it in advance
who's
yesterday.
Listening will
tomorrow.
Have already seen, hopefully.
Yeah.
And the book's called Outside the Wire. And what's the podcast called?
It's called Majority 54.
That's great.
Thank
That's
you.
A very good title. I can't believe I forgot
Thank
it.
You very much.
Thanks for being here, Jason.
Thanks for having me.
Late Night with Seth Meyers was able to get the unedited version of Sean Spicer's book, The Briefing, as read by Late Night with Seth Meyers writer John Lutz.
The Briefing by Sean Spicer. Dedicated to the Pope. Abridged version. Which has nothing to do with my height.
Chapter 1. The First Time.
The first briefing had to do with a subject we felt was most important to the American people, the size of President Trump's inauguration crowd. Boy, it was an adrenaline rush. I told those hacks it was the biggest inauguration crowd ever, period. Adding the period was all my idea. It's a way to show you're sincere and can't be challenged on your statement, period. I knew I nailed it. And yes, in retrospect, I probably should have worn a more form-fitting suit. Not because I looked like an idiot, but because the president got so angry that I was getting more attention than he was. It was the first time that he hit me.
Chapter 9. My Safe Space. An Ode.
It was my turf, my second home. In the bushes, I was free to roam. While reporters spewed lies about yours truly, the bushes convinced me that defending the president was my duty. I loved to brush up against them. It gave me a sense of calm, especially before the president would ask me what the codes were so he could drop a nuclear bomb.
Chapter 10, The Ban.
The funny thing about the travel ban, besides everything, is that it wasn't really a ban. It was a restriction. Certain people from certain countries of certain religions were prohibited from entering the United States. Not necessarily a ban, just an exclusion on entrance. I'm proud to have been the one who helped clear all that up.
Chapter 15, He Who Shall Not Be Named.
The rivalry between me and Anthony Scaramucci, I mean Scaradouchy, I mean Scaramucci, was grossly overstated. There was some competition, but it came with a little bit of mutual respect as well. When your boss forces you both to chew up his well-done steak so it's easier for him to swallow, and then makes you put it back in your mouth if it's not chewed up to his liking, you cannot help but develop a trench mentality when it comes to the guy across from you, even if he is gunning for your job.
Epilogue.
Thanks for reading. I can't wait for the book tour where throngs of adoring fans will line the streets just to catch a glimpse of me. Also, I'm still available to join a cable or network television channel as a paid or even unpaid political contributor if anyone is looking. Anyone at all. I'm always available on my cell phone, pager, landline, via fax, email, and my home address is... Also, I'll be standing on the street corners in New York City between the hours of 6 a.m. and midnight in case anyone wants to put a camera in front of me. Anyone at all?
All summer long, you've heard some of our favorite guests give some book recommendations, but for this final installment, we're going to turn it over to the late night staff to talk about what they are reading this summer.
Hi, I'm Emily, and I'm in the talent department at Late Night with Seth Meyers. And my summer read is Pachinko by Min Jin Lee. It's about this Korean family in the 20th century, and they migrate to Japan, and it's their lives over multiple decades, and you see them go through so much. And it's a beautiful book. It's a long book, but don't be scared because it's one you can't put down, and I really love it, and I hope everyone loves it too.
Hi, this is Jay Johnson, digital producer at Late Night. If you're a cinephile, or even if you're not and you just want to learn about somebody who is a master of their craft, I recommend a book by Michael Benson called Space Odyssey. This is a meticulously researched and very fascinating look at director Stanley Kubrick and the making of his film 2001: A Space Odyssey, which is of course considered one of the best films of all time. I think what makes this book so worthwhile is that it provides such a rare glimpse into how Stanley Kubrick worked as a director and how he related to people one-on-one. And it's fascinating to read how he pushed and pushed his collaborators to do things that had never been done before and to create visuals that had never been seen before, and how it just kind of drove everybody to the brink of near insanity over the course of several years in the making of this film. And if you're a fan of filmmaking, it is super interesting to read how this project developed from beginning to end and how much of it evolved during the actual production of the film, with ideas for key plot points coming from actors and other personnel. It's fascinating in that regard. And it just really points to the fact that filmmaking is such a collaborative art form. This is a really absorbing account of the making of 2001, and if you're a fan of film at all, I consider it a must-read. Enjoy!
Hello, my name is Ellen Waggett, and I'm the production designer at Late Night with Seth Meyers. And the book that I am talking about today is a little-known book that I stumbled upon at a flea market a year ago, and I just kind of picked it up randomly. I didn't really think I had any interest in it. I'd never heard of it. And it's a book called Savage Beauty, and it's written by Nancy Milford, and it is a biography of Edna St. Vincent Millay, who was a very famous American poet during the Jazz Age in America around the 1920s. She was the first woman to win a Pulitzer Prize. And this little book was so incredibly fascinating. She was a pioneer. She was fearless. She was iconic. Amazingly enough, for a poet, she was truly a rock star internationally. Traveled all over the world, read her poems, was incredibly acclaimed, and made her life out of nothing. I mean, she came from abject poverty. But the way that this story is told is so much more than just a biography, because it really gets into the depth of her very complicated relationship with her family. The woman, Nancy Milford, who wrote it, got access to all of Millay's papers after she had died. And so she has all of her journals and all of her school papers and all of her drafts of her poems and letters back and forth to her mother. And it is this incredible, tortured, beautiful, and ultimately really, really inspiring story. I hope it's a great read for the end of your summer. Enjoy.
My name is Jermaine Afonso. I'm a writer here at Late Night, and here are two book recommendations. One is Mother Night, which is by one of my favorite authors, Kurt Vonnegut. This is about an American spy who is undercover as a Nazi during World War II, and the book is presented as his fictional memoirs that he is writing in an Israeli prison. Then he's in there for war crimes, and the whole book is about him and his regrets for spreading Nazi propaganda in Germany. And it's an excellent book. It's very dark, it's funny, and I think, like a lot of things that Kurt Vonnegut does, it does a good job of being both cynical and hopeful, and he has a way of sort of plainly stating that human beings are bad people, but also finding optimism and moments of dignity and humanity. And his writing style is very, you know, it goes down very smooth. The book is super short, which is why I think it's a good summer read, despite tangentially being about World War II and the Holocaust. The other book that I liked is God of Small Things by Arundhati Roy. It's a very special, really awesome book. The author's writing style is often compared to William Faulkner, which I agree with. The book is like about a family. It's very tragic, but it's a very well-written book. It's poetic, and I feel like if you're at all interested in writing, it's a super creatively energizing book. So those are my two recommendations. I hope you like them, and if not, I am very sorry.
Hey everyone, we hope you've enjoyed listening to our Summer Friday series as much as we've enjoyed making them. Have a happy holiday weekend, and we'll see you on Tuesday when we are back with a brand new episode of Late Night.
If you like what you hear, tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night Podcast wherever they listen to podcasts. And be sure to check out Late Night with Seth Meyers on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.